Hi, this is Ken McCarthy from Jazz on the Tube, and you're listening to our podcast series. And one of the things that we'd like to do, in addition to our jazz videos, we'd like to feature people that are doing interesting things to support and expand and elaborate on our understanding of the jazz world. And it really is a jazz world. It's not just limited to the United States, as we're going to learn in this call. The passion for jazz extends around the globe. And, you know, just when you think you know everything about jazz, you open another door and there's a whole other room full of stuff that you didn't even know existed. And that's the situation that I'm in right now. I started this week not knowing something, and this week I learned something quite amazing. Our guest today is Phil Arneal, and he's a photographer, and he is working on a very interesting project with a partner, and we're going to talk about that project, but just a hint, it has to do with jazz in Japan. Now, we all know that there's a strong fan base of fans in Japan for jazz, but I didn't know about some of the nature of the infrastructure. It's fascinating. It's like nothing else on earth. I wish we had some of these places in the States. I'm even inspired maybe to start one. But anyway, let's go to our guest. Welcome, Phil. Philip.
Hi there.
Hey, Philip. Here's how I'd like to do this call, because there's so much to talk about. Could we start by talking about your colleague's work? Then I'd like to talk about your work, independent of the topic that we're going to talk about today, because I've been to your website and I've seen your photography, and it's very interesting stuff that you're doing. And then I want to talk about the main event, which I'm going to give a hint to everybody. It's called Tokyo Jazz Joints, and it's a website called tokyojazzjoints.com. Now, you might think we're talking about the typical jazz club. We're not. So hang in. Wait till you hear this story. It is just one of the most remarkable things that I've heard lately in the world of jazz. So, Philip, would you mind talking a little bit about your colleague James? And could you pronounce his last name? Is it Catchpole?
It's Catchpole, yeah.
Ah.
James he's a long-term resident of Japan, like myself. He's originally from Brooklyn, New York, and very big jazz and world music fan in particular. He likes a lot of African stuff as well, but his biggest love is jazz music. And he sort of started a labor of love, I guess, a few years ago, where he decided to kind of create an online resource of all jazz bars and clubs, and he's extended it recently into other types of music like soul and blues and so on, but the main focus was jazz, and he calls the site tokyojazzsite.com simply. And the idea is really that if you're interested in coming to Japan and you get to town and you don't know where you are and you're a big jazz fan, you can simply go to the site, look up the area that you're in, and try and locate a bar or a club that plays jazz music. And on his site, he lists some very basic, simple information like the opening hours, the address, phone number, and so on. And then he also has a little profile about what type of place it is, the kind of atmosphere, what kind of things are available there, and maybe some anecdotes about the owners as well. So over the years, James has visited these places on his own, had a chat with the owners, and kind of recorded all this information and created this fantastic resource for people coming to visit Japan.
Great. And so it sounds like, you know, it's not just a directory, but he's poured himself into it. And as you mentioned, getting to know the owners and getting to know the character of the different places. So it's not just a sterile directory. It's a real guide, a living guide to the scene there.
Absolutely. And he also has other stuff on his website. He has a blog section where he talks about different albums, live events, things like that are coming up. And he also originally did a jazz show on Tokyo Inter FM, which he's now moved to a sort of fortnightly or once every 2 weeks podcast, which goes under the name of Mr. OK Jazz Tokyo. So, yeah, he's really very actively involved in promoting jazz in many different kinds of ways.
I listened to half of his podcasts, and it's great. I got to tell you, everybody should check it out. He's got a good ear. And he's got a quirky, unique sense of the music. He picks some really good stuff. So that's Philip. Now, I mean, excuse me, that's James Catchpole. And the website, his website again is
tokyojazzsite.com, all one word.
Tokyojazzsite.com. And we'll probably have the links to all these things right underneath the interview here. But now I want to talk about your work, Philip. You're a photographer originally from Belfast?
That's correct, yeah.
And I want to talk about your work in a broad sense, not just related to the topic today, because your work's really interesting. Let's talk about one of the things. You have a beautiful series of photographs that is based on a poem about Dublin.
Okay.
Yeah, I really like that a lot.
Thank you, yeah.
You document a lot of things. Well, one of them that fascinated me, and maybe you could give me more information about this because it's completely new to me, not directly related to our topic today, which we will, I promise everybody, we're going to get to the main topic soon, but I just wanted to give you some background about these guys. There is a dance phenomenon, a cultural phenomenon in Japan related to people dancing to jazz and Latin music. Am I getting that right? And can you explain what's going on over there?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually been going for quite a long time now. This is another thing that I kind of discovered through a friend, actually, who's no longer in Japan, a guy called Lincoln Wood, who did a lot of DJing and promoting. And he was very heavily involved in this scene back in the 80s. And probably one of the people who's most knowledgeable about the scene is Snowboy, who has written a kind of a history of that whole scene. And really what it was kind of underground clubs in the 80s playing sort of not so much acid jazz, although the acid jazz movement kind of came out of that, but much heavier, darker jazz, very fast bebop, very hard sort of Latin kind of music, and almost music that's so fast and so antisocial that you would think on first listening that you can't really dance to it. But incredibly, in these clubs, initially in London, and then it also moved up in a slightly different style in the north of England, I think around Nottingham, I believe. And what the dancers did was they took sort of elements of tap dancing and later sort of ballet and combined them into just the most incredible dancing. And typically some Japanese people, as they often tend to do, went on a pilgrimage to London back in the 80s. And a group that eventually became known as Sound Cream Steppers brought this jazz dance back to Japan and somehow managed to flourish there in similar types of clubs. And amazingly, it's kind of continued over the years. And now there's almost, I would say, probably four generations, if you like, these kind of jazz dancers. Over there, they call it bebop dance. And other people refer to it as sort of UK-style jazz dance. But whatever the name you give to it, it's essentially this incredibly sort of balletic dancing to music that almost, I'm sure, the people who played it never imagined that it would be danced to. And it's thriving still in Tokyo. And strangely, really nowhere else in the world did it really take off. I think at one point there might have been a club in Toronto that was doing a kind of a similar thing. But probably now it's really only Tokyo and possibly a little bit still in the UK, but probably the strongest place for the dance and for the growth of that kind of style and the evolution of that style is amazingly in Tokyo now. And so a few years ago, I wanted to kind of document that scene before inevitably people got too old or had families and gave up and moved away. And so I started a project called, which I eventually named Tokyo Jazz Document, which you can see on my website, where really all I did was put on some music. I picked a backdrop of a local park and I brought the dancers one by one in groups. And I just asked them to dance, really. And the photographs that you see of them dancing are the dancers genuinely dancing. They're not posed or staged in any way. And I just captured them as they danced. And the idea really was just to document or take a kind of a snapshot of that scene at that point before it kind of disappeared completely.
Gotcha. And did you pick the music that they danced to?
Yeah, I picked a sort of a playlist of the kind of tunes that were often played in these bebop style events, you know. So again, fast kind of Latin, Brazilian stuff, some salsa and bebop.
Wow, and music again that people normally are unlikely to dance to.
Absolutely, yeah. I think when you hear it, you know, it's my friend Lincoln, who was heavily involved in the scene, often described it as sort of antisocial. You know, it's really, it's not the sort of music that you go to a club to even necessarily sit and listen to or have a chat or anything like that. It's just hard, very hard and fast and very, very difficult to dance to. But these dancers somehow have have managed to do it and are still doing that in various little clubs around Tokyo.
Amazing. Maybe you could send us, if there's any YouTube videos, we could include that underneath this interview so people can get a look at it, because it sounds amazing.
Absolutely.
Great. So now, so we've talked a little bit about James and a little bit about your work, your other work. Let's talk about the main event, which is this just fascinating project. I'm very lucky. I live in Hudson Valley. I'm about 70 miles from New York City, so I can get down to the city if I need to, but there's a whole lot of musicians and a whole lot of artistic energy right up here in the wood. The Falcon, which is an amazing club, is only about 20 minutes from here, and you can see just every great musician passes through there. And there's a gallery in New Paltz, which is the town I live in, and they had, it's called, what is it called, Club Love or Team Love, the name of the gallery. Team Love, it's a great name. And I happen to be reading the paper, and I saw this exhibit, and I was like, oh my God, I have to go to this. I think I was one of the first people in the door, and luckily I was able to talk a little bit with Philip. So Philip, tell us, what is this phenomenon in Japan that's going on, or that's been going on for decades, that you and James are documenting?
Well, I mean, it's essentially, in the simplest terms, it's this somewhat hidden world of tiny jazz bars and jazz cafes, which are referred to as kisaten, or for short, kisa, in Japanese, which simply means coffee shop. And about a year and a half ago, I think, I kind of had the kernel of this idea to maybe, I'm very interested, particularly in documentary photography and recording things for posterity. And so I approached James, who I knew vaguely through various club events and other kinds of things, and he'd been to previous exhibitions of mine, and I pitched the kind of the project to him, the idea being obviously that James, with his knowledge of all these places and the resources that he had, and myself as a photographer, that we could combine those two and really document and record this scene. And one of the main reasons for doing that is that a lot of these places have been open now for, in some cases, in one form or other, more than 50 years, and certainly a lot of them from the 60s and 70s, and remained virtually unchanged, but they're kind of gradually, one by one, disappearing for various reasons. Tokyo is a city that's constantly changing and evolving. The owners are getting older, or some of them have become ill and are unable to run a business. And really, these places, you know, they're not designed to make money. They're very much a labor of love. They're very much a sort of a passion or a vocation. And so there's no one who really wants to take them over, be it in the owner's family or friends or acquaintances or anyone really. So one by one, these places are closing. And when we started to document these bars and cafes, the way that we've been doing it is using James's knowledge of the places themselves. We've kind of made a list, and we've been going through the bars and cafes in order, in the order that we think they may not have much longer to run. So the first photograph, the first places we photographed are ones that are perhaps there's a rumor that it may be closing soon, or we know for a fact that the owner has been ill or something else has happened. And so we started the project this year around March, and every Friday night we meet up after work and we go to one or two places. Maybe if schedules suit, we go once midweek. So we're hitting maybe two or three places a week and simply going in, having a chat with the owners. James knows quite a lot of the owners from previous work. I have a couple of drinks, ask permission to photograph. Then one by one, we're posting the photographs up on the website. And to date, we've photographed, I think in total, although not completely, 27 places. And we estimate that probably at least there's another 80 places which we could potentially document, photograph. So it's very much a work in progress, but one that's kind of gathered some momentum as we've started to get into it more. And then obviously with the exhibition at the Team Love Raven House Gallery in New Paltz, that's kind of really kick-started it again. And we're hoping in the future to have some more exhibitions, both over here in the States and obviously back in Tokyo. And we'll see where it goes from there, really.
Great. And hey, if anybody's listening who, you know, has, you know, has a club or a restaurant or a cafe or a gallery, this is good stuff. This is really interesting stuff. Especially, I think this would be perfect in New Orleans, or it would be perfect in a jazz club. It's just very unique stuff. So let's talk about the character of these joints. And by the way, the website again is?
TokyoJazzJoints.com.
Great. TokyoJazzJoints.com. And Tokyo is T-O-K-Y-O.
Right.
JazzJoints.com. So let's talk about a typical, we call these kisses?
Kisa or bars. I mean, it really depends. I mean, without getting too much into the finer details, really, some of the places open as cafes in the daytime and perhaps close in the early evening. Other places open from, say, 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock. And generally speaking, those places, you know, serve alcohol and are more like a bar. Other places are open during the daytime. And some of the places open maybe from 11 in the morning right through. And then, you know, they have a cafe time until late afternoon. And then they kind of switch to bar time. But, yeah, jazz bars or jazz kisa or jazz coffee shops is fine.
And we should probably put this in a larger context of Japan street life. And I've never been in Japan, but I did live in Japantown in San Francisco for about 8 years and got to know a lot of Japanese people. And read a lot about it, and I don't know, I just absorbed a lot of understanding, I think. And one of the things that I understand, if I am correct, is that Japan's packed with these little social spaces, like, a noodle shop, and it may only be as big as your kitchen at home, and people come and go, and, and that's just the life on the street, because there's just all these little joints of various kinds, with different themes and different things that they're offering. And so that this phenomenon sort of fits into that larger fabric. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. They're often tucked away. I mean, they're hidden in sometimes in literal ways because they're up tiny staircases. They only have a sign outside, or anyone who's been to Japan will know that often you only see half the picture unless you look up, because so many places are stacked on top of each other. And they're also hidden in more metaphorical ways, in that they're often, through no fault of the owners or anything else, but perhaps there's a perception that, you can't go in there, or it's not very welcoming, or if you're not a local or you haven't been there before, it's not somewhere that you can go. And equally for people who are visiting Japan from abroad, a lot of these places often have like a sit-down charge, so this can sometimes lead to difficulties, particularly with tourists, because they start to think that perhaps when they get the bill, they're being ripped off somehow or overcharged because of who they are. This is, again, not really the case at all. It's simply that, like you say, in Japan, with a lot of bars in particular, and sometimes with restaurants, there is kind of a sit-down or an extra charge. So as a result, a lot of the places, they have maybe a hardcore of regulars, generally speaking men, but they're not the sort of places that, unless you really know about them or you're really determinedly looking for them, they're not the sort of places you're going to kind of wander into by accident.
Sure. And if you don't speak Japanese and the owner doesn't speak English, there could be all sorts of confusion too. And I think Japanese people are very friendly, but they're also kind of insular. They're not necessarily looking to bring the world into their scene. So, yeah, it is tricky if you don't know your way around or you don't have introductions. So these are really clubs in the true sense of the word. In other words, it's the same guys that show up every day, same group of guys, I guess. It's their hangout.
That's often the case, I think. I mean, we found actually that people have been very welcoming. James, as I've said, has been in many of these places before, maybe recently or 2 or 3 years ago, perhaps when he last was there to profile the place. But there's not been any occasion, for example, where people have said, please don't take photographs and so on. And I think actually in many ways, a lot of the owners, the Japanese owners, are pleased that other people are coming, actually, because, you know, it's injecting life into the business, injecting money into the business. And often they're kind of flattered that we're so interested or we're so fascinated or that we even want to take pictures of the bar or cafe or the owners themselves. So we found them people to be very welcoming. Now, both of us speak Japanese fluently, so perhaps that's also helped sort of oil the wheels a little bit. But generally speaking, people have been very receptive to the project. And I'm looking forward to going back to Japan in a few weeks to take maybe some prints to some of the different owners and explain that they've been displayed in a gallery in New York State and so on.
Yeah, you can tell them they're now linked to Jazz on the Tube.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're paying attention to what they're doing, and we like it. So let's set the scene. So it's obvious, these clubs are obviously not on the main, you know, boulevard. They're maybe off on side streets. You mentioned they might be upstairs. They tend to be kind of smallish, some of them, right, usually?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think it's almost sort of an Alice in Wonderland type feel. You often got these tiny staircases, and, you know, it's hard not to feel a bit like the sort of clumsy foreigner as you kind of clatter in, and you feel like far too large, and, you know, the roofs are very low, and the toilets are often sort of tiny cramped spaces. And I would say the majority of the places that we're in, you know, at a push, you maybe got seating for 8 to 12 people maximum. Some of the places are slightly bigger, and some have done some renovations and opened them up slightly, but they're generally quite small. They're generally quite cramped. And the older places are a little frayed at the edges, and there's almost a feeling that you're kind of stepping back in time a little bit, because they haven't really changed probably since they've opened in most ways. And, you know, you have faded posters and concert ticket stubs and other kinds of things on the wall decorating them. And it's just one of those things, really, that it's almost very hard to explain in words what it's like being there. You know, as you're sitting watching the scene, sometimes you kind of think, how can you really explain this to someone? And I think what we're trying to do with Tokyo Jazz Joints is at least give people some kind of flavor of what it's like and the kind of things that you see when you go to these places and who the owners are, to kind of shed a little bit more light on it and to kind of make people see them, I think, in a different light, because probably even within Japan, Jazz Kisa or Jazz Bar kind of probably conjures up a certain image that I think is not, that probably doesn't align with what the reality of these places are actually like. So it'll be interesting, I think, when we go back to Japan, to also show these photos to a Japanese audience, because I think they will probably have a slightly different perspective on them as well.
So first and foremost, the places are small, and they have a certain, from looking at your photographs and from you and I talking yesterday, they have a certain shrine-like quality. For example, you, in one of the photographs, you see, and this is apparently something that's part of the scene, is they have very beautifully built, very sophisticated sound system, some of the places. And you mentioned that sometimes it's set up in a theater style, small room, of course, but still theater style, with everybody pointing in the same direction of the sound system, which might be made of, might be handmade speakers.
Absolutely. It's hard not to sort of see the similarities. Again, if anyone is familiar with, not necessarily even Japanese, but when you go into the sort of inner sanctum of a temple, there's often things flanking on either side, and then in the middle there's a sort of an assortment of artifacts or statues or whatever it might be. And often when you go into a lot of these places, particularly ones that are slightly bigger and have the space to play with, you often find these two huge speakers which sort of flank an amplifier and then a sort of a little assortment of objects or records or something else in the middle. And it looks very much like a shrine-like setup. And a lot of the places are very proud of these sound systems. And there are people who are doing a similar thing to James and I, where they kind of do a pilgrimage around different jazz bars because they're so interested in the audio equipment. And they're actually going and sort of checking out the speakers and checking out the turntables. And because they're often, in many cases, handmade and may even be completely original to the shop or bar that they're in. And the owners will often mention the speakers and are quite proud of these. And this was very much a thing, I think, particularly back in the day before people had the access to having sound systems in their house and so on, where this would also be a draw. And some of the older places, like we discussed last night, the seats are set up not necessarily not to talk. I mean, you could sit beside someone and talk with them, but if you look forwards, it's very much like a cinema or a theater type feel, where you're looking at the backs of people's heads as all the tables and the whole direction of the room faces towards the speakers, because when these kind of jazz joints were originally set up, it was very much for people to congregate, but predominantly to listen to music that they didn't have access to themselves in their own houses. And so that's still, in some of the jazz joints, has kind of persisted until today, where that's the setup of the furniture. It's very much the focus is on the music and the speakers.
Gotcha. So someone would, you know, after work or maybe during the day, you know, head up to the club and get a coffee or get a drink, sit down and enjoy the music. Let's talk about the music, because you were pointing out that some of these clubs have just remarkable LP collections, vinyl collections.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they, again, the passage of time being what it is, some places have switched to CDs for space reasons. And so what we often find is there's a mixture of both now. But there are places which still exclusively play vinyl. And obviously, as you can imagine, if you've been buying records in that kind of commercial capacity to attract customers for, in some cases, 30, 40, maybe 50 years, you end up amassing an incredible collection of records. There's one bar just outside Tokyo in a place called Chiba, which is called Candy, and you can find that on the website as well. The owner there, Hayashi-san, she talked to us quite a lot when we went and explained that she'd been collecting records since she was a teenager. She used to get off school. She wandered around an area of Tokyo called Shinjuku, a very bohemian district in the 1960s. And she said in most of the shops in those days, the background music, and also in a lot of the electrical shops, was always jazz. So she was walking around and hearing jazz all the time, and kind of got into it through that and started to buy records. And she's been running this now since her early 20s. So, you know, she's looking at maybe 50 years collecting records. And so just an incredible collection of vinyl. And what's really amazing is that so many, it seems to the sort of the casual observer, that so many of the places, there's just racks and shelves of records, but there doesn't seem to be any discernible filing system. That said, if you asked for Sonny Rollins or John Coltrane or Ella Fitzgerald or Carmen McRae or whoever it was, they can pretty much instantly go to a section and pull out 2-3 records, or in some cases, the record that you're looking for specifically. So how they do this, it's kind of a bit of a mystery. We're not sure yet, but there seems to always be a system, and it's just a fascinating thing to watch, really.
Oh, that's great. They probably, the bottom line is they just really know their collections. There's probably, as with many things with Japan, there's probably some secret system that's not apparent to the casual observer.
Absolutely.
Wow, man, I want to go to Japan and see this stuff. Now, let's talk about the history of these places, because I think that's important to have a picture of. You mentioned one of the clubs was started in the 30s and was closed down, which makes sense, you know, because we had the war, of course, closed down by the police, secret police, and then reopened. That's sort of an unusual story. But you were mentioning, and in the exhibit, the notes said that a lot of these places started after the war. Of course, Japan was occupied, so there were a lot of U.S. troops there who were jazz fans. But the other part of the story, which is really important and almost hard to visualize, you have to almost get some old movies to really picture the devastation in Japan after the war. I mean, it was total, and everything was short. I mean, it's hard to even conceive for us. None of us have ever lived through anything like it. But food was scarce, housing was scarce, safety was scarce. It was just a rough and difficult place. And so these clubs probably were created at the scale they were because that was what was affordable. It was, you know, you couldn't have a big room, but you could have a little room. So I imagine, I mean, this is, people did not have records. They did not have record players at home. That was beyond, they were worried about getting rice, not about having a sound system and getting the latest LPs from the States. So these clubs must have been really avant-garde when they were in the 40s and 50s.
Absolutely, yeah. I think you've hit the nail really on the head. I mean, I think property and certainly housing was so scarce. I mean, most of Tokyo was built from wood, and obviously when it was firebombed, it simply burned down. So, you know, it was a case of rebuilding the whole city. So housing was very much at a premium. And so, you know, if you're struggling to get those basic things, the last thing you're thinking about is, well, I must get a gramophone, or I must get some records. And so, but equally, you had this kind of contrasting situation where you had a lot of American troops in Japan. And probably as a result of that, I imagine you had a lot of music coming in, particularly through port cities, like places like Yokohama in particular. And the place that you refer to that opened in 1933 is called Chigusa. And it's based in Yokohama, right down by that port area. So my understanding of it is that, you know, these places grew up as a kind of a social space, I guess, for people to gather, but also almost like an economic imperative, because if you can't afford to buy records and you want to hear music, there was an opening for these people to create this space where you could come and hear these records but not break the bank balance. I think it was also a place for musicians, both probably perhaps less so at the time Japanese, but certainly American musicians as well, to play and to have gigs and that kind of thing and jam with other musicians. And so they really filled that kind of niche, I think, for that sort of demand to hear music, both live and recorded. And again, after the war, through the 50s and the 60s, the number of these jazz bars continued to increase.
And there are live gigs at these places, but these would be the smallest jazz clubs imaginable, right, in terms of
layout.
I think
if you went to them, you know, even when I go, James and I, when we go ourselves, you know, every time you've got to pinch yourself almost because you see a poster that says, you know, concert this weekend or a session this weekend. And you just think to yourself, well, where? You know, simply how? How would you get three or four musicians in here and be able to actually have customers as well? But they do it. And, you know, they love it and seems to work. And so, you know, why not? There's one particular place that we went to. Again, one of those sort of experiences that you kind of, you want other people to experience it with you, because explaining it doesn't really do it justice. But it's a place called Intro, which is also on the site. And again, one of those almost cinematic experiences where we wandered in. There was some musicians playing, jamming at one end of the bar. And we came in, sat down, sat at the bar for maybe 15, 20 minutes. No one there serving us, couldn't get a drink. And then a song finished and the saxophone player put his sax down, came to the bar. What would you like? Gave us our three drinks. And we paid him and he put the sax on and went back in and joined the band again. And just a wonderful, wonderful kind of place to be. And as we stayed there for about an hour and a half, there was a gradual stream of musicians who came in with their instruments, and they just kept switching up, dropping in and out of the band and jamming. And, you know, this is maybe 4 or 5 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon. So, you know, this just shows kind of how much, very much out of the mainstream, because the impression of Japanese life and Japanese work life in particular is this kind of long commute and working, you know, crazy hours at the office and so on. But this is happening in these little pockets around the city at, you know, 4 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon. People are just jamming, they're playing jazz, and it's just a wonderful thing.
Wow. Yeah, the creativity of the Japanese people and Japanese culture is just amazing. You know, and we're just talking about one narrow, tiny little phenomenon. There's probably thousands of phenomena like this in other artistic expressions. It's just, yeah, there is an amazing culture. It's an amazing culture that really, we were talking about this, you know, for instance, one tradition in Japan is to have full moon viewing parties. So, you know, it's the full moon, you know, most of us ignore it. But traditionally, in the old days, and maybe some people still today, they would have a party, and the whole party would be based around the fact that there's a full moon. And everyone would be out in the garden and looking at the moon, enjoying each other's company and enjoying this thing. And this sort of social, this sort of planned, I don't want to say ritualized, because it's not, you know, it's not fixed and, you know, super formal, but this idea of creating occasions and creating social spaces where people can get together and enjoy beauty together, I think is uniquely Japanese. It's a wonderful thing we could all adopt.
The equivalent of that, I think, in this Tokyo jazz joints world is a lot of the cafes and bars, perhaps more so the cafes, but they organize a kind of a listening party. So there's one particular photograph in this exhibition in Team Love Ravenhouse Gallery where it just says simply John Coltrane, and then in Japanese the very simple translation is sort of John Coltrane Special, the 17th of every month from 6 to 9 p.m. And that's just a fixed thing. And if you go on the 17th at 6 o'clock, you'll hear 3 hours straight of John Coltrane records. And, you know, lots of places have these kind of things. And it often depends on the owner's particular favorite genre of jazz, or a lot of the jazz owners are particularly expert on one certain musician that they particularly fell in love with. And other cafes organize kind of listening parties for perhaps an album or perhaps an artist. And there's one cafe that's opened recently, actually, by a guy called Jofu-san, who has run a record label for many years, reissuing and issuing some original jazz records. And he's opened a cafe recently down in Yokohama near Chinatown. And on his website, they have a schedule simply of these listening events where people get together, like you say, in a social context, have a drink, have a coffee, and they simply enjoy listening to the records by one particular artist or one particular genre. And it's a fantastic thing, yeah.
And you mentioned that in some of the places, silence is the watchword.
Yes, well, I think we've not been to anywhere yet that still maintains this policy, but I think certainly in days gone by, a lot of places would have had a designated time where there was no talking other than perhaps to order a drink. James often tells the story of when he first went into a place called Eagle in an area of Tokyo called Yotsuya. And I think he'd just recently come to Japan, thought this place was great, brought a friend along, and spent then the time that he was in the cafe sort of being shushed and hushed by the owner. And he couldn't understand at the time what the problem was, but it was only on his return visit, when he could read a little bit more Japanese, that he spotted the sign saying no talking from 1 to 5 p.m. And so he was sort of breaking the code of silence, if you like. And again, that's all about really, I think, just listening to the music and the reason that you're there to appreciate the music. And if it's to kind of just to have a chat and the music is kind of a secondary or a background thing, then I think probably the suggestion is, well, there's plenty of other coffee shops nearby that you could go to instead.
Yeah, it's just amazing. It's just amazing. I'm glad these places exist, and I'm really glad you guys are documenting them. And I understand James gives tours, so if somebody happens to be in Japan and wants to experience this, he can facilitate that.
Absolutely, yes. If you contact James through his website, tokyojazzsite.com, he's more than happy to do that. And of course, anyone who's interested and happen to be in town, we'd be more than happy to have people with us when we're photographing and going to the different places. I think it's, again, like I've mentioned before, perhaps intimidating. And as anyone knows, going to a new city, it takes a while to find your feet and get your bearings. And of course, having someone who knows where they're going like that and who can put together a little simple itinerary, you know, where you're not wasting time wandering around with Google Maps trying to find where you are, is a great thing. And so often he'll get people coming through for maybe the weekend or a couple of nights. They're there on holiday or in business. And he'll pick one or two places depending on what the people want. And he's happy to do those kind of tours, yeah.
Wow. And of course, I think everybody knows, but we should probably say, Tokyo is one of the biggest cities in the world, so definitely not a place to land and improvise if you only have a day or two.
Exactly.
You spend a day or two just getting out of the airport and figuring out how to get downtown. Wow. So let's repeat the site. So it's Japan Jazz Joints?
Tokyo Jazz.
Oh, Tokyo.
So, I mean, we started off with the project, tokyojazzjoints.com, but what we found, of course, is that there's places in Yokohama, and more as we talk to people, we're getting a sense that there's more than one or two dotted in other cities and other places around. So the name started tokyojazzjoints.com, but what we imagine to happen is perhaps that eventually it's going to develop a little bit further. So that's the name of the project, but it's very much documenting these places all over Japan, and the further afield that we can get in terms of having the time and having the resources and the finances to do that, that's kind of what we're planning. So the website is Tokyo, T-O-K-Y-O, jazzjoints.com. And James's site is tokyojazzsite.com. And if you go to either of those sites, you can find us. You can find out more about the project.
Great. And through one of those sites, they can link to your personal site with your photographs as well.
Absolutely. My website is simply my name, philiparneal.com. And I've had a lifetime of misspelling, so I can spell it very quickly now. It's philiparneal.com.
Got it. Kind of like O'Neill, but with A-R instead of
That's
O.
That's it. Yeah, we wanted our name to be a bit more exclusive, I think.
Very good. Wow. I just, you know, jazz is amazing. And here it finds this just unique expression, the appreciation of jazz, the enjoyment of jazz finds this unique expression in Japan that few of us, I certainly didn't know, I didn't even have a dream that this even existed. And I'm glad it does. These sound like shrines, jazz shrines that just happen to serve drinks too.
I think they really are. And I think the sad thing is that, you know, as with anything, perhaps it's starting to disappear. And I mean, it's very hard to put a number on it, but I would imagine within probably 20 years, certainly, the majority of these places, unless something drastic changes, or perhaps Tokyo Jazz Joints will breathe new life into it and bring a new wave of customers to these places. But for the reasons I've mentioned already, you know, that they're kind of gradually disappearing from the Tokyo streets. And it's a sad thing because they are, like you say, places that have been very singular in purpose. They've kind of protected and nurtured jazz and appreciation and jazz musicians in Tokyo and in Japan. And I highly recommend anyone that is either in Tokyo or wants to come to please come and see these places before while you still can.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we'll make this the parting note. You know, we live in this world of virtual music. You know, there's everything, you know, everything's being streamed and everything's in the cloud and everybody's listening to their iPhone or their Android. And here we have these spaces where people physically come together. They're listening to physical media. They're not listening through some tinny earphone. They're actually listening through some handcrafted, handmade, perhaps entirely unique sound system. And who knows? This, you know, vinyl came back, is coming back. Maybe this will be, your project will be the seed to awaken people, jazz lovers all over the world. Why not start? Because, you know, there are jazz societies in every city in America. Maybe some of these jazz societies might think about, you know, opening up a little, you know, listening club. Again, you know, your hours can be whatever you want them to be. And, you know, why couldn't this spread beyond Japan? I guess the reason it couldn't spread is nobody knew about it. But thanks to you and James, now people do. So I wish you guys the best of luck. And again, any listeners, if you think there's any way you can help these guys, be in touch with them and give them a hand, because this is really, to me, as a lover of jazz, this is a precious thing that's going on in the best sense of the word, the highest sense of the word. And now we know why there are so many jazz fans in Japan. They didn't just, you know, fall out of the sky. There was a whole infrastructure to spread the music, even at a time when nobody could afford their own turntable or records. So, Philip, thanks so much for the time. Please say hi to James for me. And everybody, it's tokyojazzjoints.com. And from there, you can get to the other sites that we talked about. I'll have the links below on the interview. Again, thanks a lot, Philip.
Thank you very much, Ken. It's been a pleasure.